From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we'll be talking about the battle between Lake Michigan and the Illinois towns fighting to hold back the water. My guest will be Dan Egan, a journalist and author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. That's later this hour. But first, the general interest newspaper column is a burden and a privilege. A burden because it's a giant, high-profile hamster wheel. The work is never done. The prize for meeting a deadline is the next deadline. But it's also a privilege. You get to roam the city, talking to people from all walks of life. You can put impudent questions to the self-important and shine a light for those struggling in darkness. But the institution of the general interest newspaper column is changing and arguably disappearing. I can't speak for everywhere in Illinois, but when Metro columnists leave, they tend not to be replaced. That certainly happened at the State Journal Register in Springfield. I'm sure you've seen it in your hometowns, too. And last month, we added at least two more names to Illinois' list of former Metro columnists. Mary Schmeek joined the Chicago Tribune in 1985 and started writing her column in 1992. Along the way, she also wrote the Brenda Starr comic strip and won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Eric Zorn joined the Tribune more than 41 years ago, and after working in the arts section in a suburban bureau, he became a columnist in 1986. Along the way, he launched the paper's first blog and was publishing a newsletter well before that became trendy. Between the two of them, they've written thousands and thousands of columns, literally millions of words, at a pace of three times a week. And last month, they both filed their final columns for the Tribune, taking buyouts as the paper enters a new phase of out-of-town ownership. Mary Schmeek and Eric Zorn join me now to talk about their careers and the changing news business. Mary, Eric, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Brian. As you said, thousands and thousands of columns. I had this image of columns just pouring down torrentially from the heavens. incessant.
Descent. More of a slow drizzle over the decades, I guess.
Drip, maybe is the way to think of it. I wanted to get to 5,000 columns. I figured about 4,300, and I was hoping to make it to an even 5,000, but it was not to be.
Not to be, yeah. Well, all right. I want to start with the big picture, this idea of the column, the Metro column. Mary, when you took on this assignment, what did you think of your role? How did you conceive your role?
Well, I took the word Metro fairly seriously. Metro as opposed to, say, op-ed columnist, right? So I understood that I was coming into the city of Chicago, to the Chicago Tribune, to write a column that didn't have to focus exclusively on Chicago, but had to make some sense, have some meaning to the place that we lived. And that a lot of times it did involve focusing just on Chicago. So it wasn't an op-ed column that could run anywhere in the country and make sense to people necessarily, right? Though it might be of some interest to them. And to me, it meant telling stories, at least as much as I had opinions, because I just think that belongs to a tradition of Metro columnists that goes way back. Most of those columnists through time have been men, but as I noted when I wrote my farewell column, I also knew that, you know, I was not going to be Mike Royko. I was not going to be Jimmy Breslin. I wasn't going to be the men who had defined the Metro column. But there was a lot that I learned from them about how to do that.
And I want to come back to those questions. But Eric, same question to you. When you first started this role as a Metro columnist, how did you conceive of what you were trying to do?
Well, my route to becoming a columnist is a little different from Mary's in that Mary was plucked from the Atlanta Bureau. She was a national correspondent for the Tribune, and they sort of negotiated with her about coming back. They wanted her to come and be a big time columnist here. I came up through a totally different route. I was out in the suburbs as a general assignment news reporter trying to write human interest stories, features that were modeled after a column in the New York Times that was called Our Towns. And so I was out there looking for slices of life, essentially, trying to define the area that I was writing about, not by the big stories about land use and politics out there, but about how people were interacting with their schools, with their communities. I did a lot of neighborhood dispute stories. I did a lot of, you know, wacky inventor stories, just telling the stories of people out in the suburbs that defined life there as being not just bedroom communities, but really these vibrant areas of life. And then that column evolved into the Metro column that I had for a long time, that I shared a space with Mary. When Mary came up from Atlanta, I was writing these suburban columns, and Mary, as I recall, Mary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Mary sort of said, look, I don't want to have to just write about the city. That Mary thought that her role as a columnist was truly metropolitan and not the city. And before that, there was sort of a city column and a suburban column. And Mary said, look, I want to be able to write about the suburbs if they interest me. I want to write about the city if it interests me. And so because Mary got to do that, I went and said, hey, but if Mary gets to do it, then I get to do it too. So this was in the early 90s.
There was also the idea that, you know, we wanted to expand it to also having opinions, to not exclusively having opinions, but, you know, on the Metro page, which is where our column ran, there wasn't any opinion. And so little by little, Eric and I pushed those boundaries, you know, that, okay, now we're going to tell some stories, but we're also going to have some opinions.
Yeah, before that time, the columns were where you would find this interesting writing and you'd find these offbeat stories, and all the other reporters were assigned to the buildings and the serious news stories and so on. And that had started to change. And there were a lot of really great feature writers who were writing for the news side. And so, like, and our colleague Steve Johnson, our former colleague Steve Johnson, was certainly one of those young reporters who was, you know, multi-talented, was able to write the same kind of stories that we were writing very well, so that there was not this, like, oh, here's where the person who knows how to write has a column, and we give them a column, and they write things that are actually well-written, and everybody else writes these straight-ahead, inverted pyramid news stories. That was changing. So that the whole definition of what we were doing really broadened out to being opinion and being storytelling. And I know Mary and I had many conversations over the years that a Metro column was something, our view of it was, it was something that was of interest to people in the metropolitan area, which could be a national story. So that if there was some big national story that people locally were talking about a lot, we felt like, well, that's a Metro story. That's a local story. When 9/11 happened, that was a local story. There were many, many local angles. People here were talking about it. You can't say, well, 9/11 happened, but that happened in New York, so I'm going to write about some Parkway dispute in Evanston or something like that. Now you had to define Metro in a very broad way, and I feel like it was very successful. Mary and I shared a space for what, 15, 20 years almost, Mary, something like that.
Yeah, long time.
A long time that we shared a space. And the only reason that we stopped sharing a space was that space became at a premium in the Metro section as the newspaper shrunk.
Well, they killed the Metro section. I mean, you know, what happened was at some point, you know, some ownership, Sam Zell, it's hard to keep this all straight, but the standalone Metro section disappeared.
Yeah. So there was no space to have this share. We didn't have a shared space anymore. They were just moving our columns around various places. And so since I tended to be more of the politics and policy geek, they stuck me back in the op-ed section. So I went to work with the people on the editorial board. I was never a member of the editorial board, but I worked with those people for starting in about 2009. We no longer shared a space, although to the very day of our mutual, what's the word you're looking for, Mary? We transitioned. We're going into
our transition, not retirement. Transition.
We entered our transition phase on the same day. Up until that day, there were many people who just associated the two of us together because of the space we shared. We conducted these columns occasionally. Several times a year, we would do letters to each other. Where a column would be like, I would say, "Dear Mary, what do you think about this? Here's what I think," and she'd say, "Dear Eric, here's what I think about it." We would sort of bounce ideas off each other in print. And then, of course, every December for the last 22 years, is it now, Mary? Mary and I had co-hosted this program called Songs of Good Cheer at the Old Town School of Folk Music, where we
I want to come back to that. I'm going to ask you to put a pin in that sort of outside of the newspaper work. But Mary, I want to ask you. You mentioned Mike Royko, and obviously he looms large over Chicago newspaper column writing. How did you? Was it a sort of a conscious choice to chart your own course? I wonder if you, or did you feel like you were working in, you know, the shadow of him and other people earlier on? How did you navigate that?
You know, I never really felt I was working in his shadow. I think other people may have thought I was working in his shadow, but, you know, it was very clear to me that he was Mike and I was me, and I was younger and I was female and I'd had a very different life, and that the only way I could write a column was to write it out of my own experience and my own voice. So, you know, I was never trying to mimic him or you know, emulate or any of that. But I do think that, you know, anybody who wrote a Metro column or this style of column, which is a combination of reporting and opinionating, reporting on the ground locally and opinionating, the influence of, you know, a handful of really well-known men, there's no way you can get away from the idea that there was some influence there. But I never felt I was copying him. And you asked if it was conscious. It was conscious, but it wasn't exactly deliberate. It wasn't like I was stomping my foot and going, I'm going to write my own column. I'm not going to write like Mike Royko. It's just, I just wrote like me. So in retrospect, I can analyze it, but.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask, you both came to newspapers in around the same time in the early 1980s. After Watergate, Mely, there was a lot of prestige to being a newspaper reporter at the time. And you're exiting or transitioning, or however you want to say it, the industry, when the former president and a large number of Americans think of us as the enemy of the people. I wonder how that change in prestige has felt from your desks. And Eric, maybe I'll start with you.
Well, there's no doubt that 40 years ago, newspapers and newspaper columnists were much more important and influential, that Mike Royko was very talented and deserved the acclaim that he got. I don't think you're going to see in American newspapers, I don't think you see now, anybody like Mike Royko or Jimmy Breslin or any of these newspaper columnists that stand astride a city or a region the way those people, or Mike Barnicle even in his day, that newspapers just aren't as important as they were. The circulation is way down, and the number of competing news outlets and ambitious news outlets has multiplied. So you just don't have that kind of a pulpit anymore. So yeah, I would say that over the years, certainly I would find that a lot of people knew who I was and then people are related to it, but there was never any sense that the days of Mike Royko and Bob Green and the major columnists that we had in the city, those days are gone. John Cass was thrust into the Mike Royko pulpit after Royko died. But Cass was never as big as Royko, or even as close to as big as Royko, and that's not a reflection on John. It's just a reflection of the times that the Tribune wasn't as important. That those days are gone.
And Mary, what is the cost to? I wonder, because the Tribune is not. I mean, you mentioned Metro columnist and Metropolitan. It's not just Chicagoland. It's the most important news outlet in the state, certainly. Perhaps even the entire Midwest. What is the loss to civic life when institutions like the Tribune are reduced as much as they've been in recent decades?
Well, I mean, I think there are several losses. One of the losses is just the loss of the resources to go and report / investigate / analyze / interpret the place that we live. You know, just we have lost so many people. There are not nearly as many people to go out and just do the work. And an attached consequence is we are losing a certain kind of connectivity. I keep thinking of the word connective tissue, you know, that a really strong Metro newspaper is an important part of the connective tissue of a place, that when it's just kind of understood that a whole lot of people are reading the same newspaper, maybe two newspapers, When people are getting their information from a shared source, when a lot of them, certainly not all of them ever, but a lot of them are getting their information from a shared source, there's just a connectivity there. You know, it's a way of connecting people to the arts in their place, to the food in their place, not just to the news. So I think sometimes we overemphasize the loss of investigative reporting. That's huge too. Don't get me wrong. That's huge. But the loss of these other kinds of connections, I think it is great when you no longer have really strong, big newspapers.
You think
right,
it's...
We,
you think,
and I'm
you
sorry think, to interrupt you. We need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. I'm speaking with Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek, former columnists with the Chicago Tribune. They both departed last month as part of a wide range of departures from the paper as some out-of-town ownership looks to cut costs there. We're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Mary Schmeek and Eric Zorn, former columnists from the Chicago Tribune, about their decisions to depart the paper as out-of-town ownership company. I guess they're not new owners per se, but they have a greater ownership control of the paper and have been looking to cut costs. And before the break, we were talking about the cost to the civic life of not only Chicago, but Illinois and really the entire Midwest as the paper is shrinking. Eric, you were trying to get in before the break. Sorry, I had to interrupt you.
Yeah, I'm just saying that what Mary talks about connectivity and the connectivity issues of a newspaper. It's very true that a newspaper is not just about the politics and the institutions and the coverage of major issues, but it is about creating, generating, pushing forward all these conversations that people have. It sets the table for the civic conversation about not just politics, but arts and food and culture and so on. And in some ways, that's, I think Mary and I both saw this as our role as columnists was not so much to wag our fingers at people and tell them what to think, but to advance conversations, to move the ball along. I had an editor who used to say, how is this column moving the conversation forward, advancing the conversation, making, you know, inviting more people into the dialogue that we have. So that's what a newspaper does. And as it shrinks, as its influence shrinks, as its presence in the community shrinks, you tend to see a fragmentation of that. So you don't have everyone sort of on the same, talking about the same issues and using the same sets of facts to talk about things. So it's not good. I'm glad that we do have the multiplicity of voices out there. I think it's good that we have in Chicago, we have things like Block Club and Tribe, and we have our local radio station here, WBEZ, has a very strong newsroom. I think that's all very good. But there is, in fact, when newspapers are diminished or brought down in a level, you do have a difference in the kind of dialogue that people have.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because you talked about, and Mary talked about investigative work, and there's a lot of attention when people talk about the decline of newspapers and, say, focusing on the investigative work that goes undone. But you can get money now, nonprofit money, if you want to start a criminal justice news outlet or for the environment. It's maybe more of a struggle, but if you want to target a certain community in Chicago, you can, maybe I see people finding money to start up news outlets like that. But the idea of a sort of eclectic, interesting stories from around the city mixed with personal anecdotes and life advice. I mean, will there be a future for the Metro Column in whatever new world of news we're entering, Mary?
Well, good question, Brian. What's your answer? You know, I'm not optimistic for this particular subset of column. You know, columns have increasingly come to be associated with the word opinion, and opinion is increasingly associated with the idea of partisan. And, you know, I think that what we're going to see, this is not new, but everything is accelerated, and an accelerated version of this idea that columns are places where people park their partisan, nationally partisan political opinions.
You know, Mary, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, well, I think that there is an increasing role, given all these voices out there, there is an increasing role, increasing importance for people who can analyze the news, who can, as I say, move the conversation forward, who can be a trusted voice to discuss what the facts are and to offer an interpretation of those facts. I don't think there's ever going to be a diminution in the need or the desire for those kind of voices. It's just a question of who is going to hire them, who's going to pay their salaries, who's going to promote them, who's going to get them into the onto the screens, that's probably the way to put it, of readers. I believe very strongly that the idea of a Metro columnist, that these trusted voices, and this is what people have said to me in letter after letter, that they miss my voice, they miss Mary's voice, they miss Darlene, they miss the other people who have left. They're missing those voices because these are voices they know and they trust and they want to be in at least imaginary dialogue with. I think there's a strong need for that, and I hope that it continues, and I hope that the next generations of publishers find a place for those kinds of voices.
Right. I mean, what you're seeing now is that a lot of columnists, analyzers, opinionators are going to, say, Substack or to, you know, their own personal outlet in order to say what they have to say. And that the newer news outlets, say ProPublica, as far as I know, ProPublica doesn't have columnists, right?
No, they don't.
You know, they do great work. But to your point, Brian, you know, they're outlets that are really focused on investigative reporting, or in some cases, neighborhood reporting, but just reporting, no columnists. So where does that leave columnizing, analyzing, heart-to-heart stuff, you know?
Well, I would argue, Mary, that those news outlets that don't have that kind of voice in them are really missing a bet. And there may be some tax reasons why they don't do that. I'm not sure, but I don't know why a place like ProPublica would not have more opinion voices, why a place like Block Club wouldn't have people who are doing more analysis and to go along with their reporting. Because I do think, from my experience in dealing with readers for all these years, there is a hunger for that and an interest in that. And the way they identify and relate to a publication has to do with the people who are part of it.
But there's also a danger to it. I mean, in an increasingly partisan world, though actually every time I say increasingly partisan, I wonder if that's actually true. But in such a bitter partisan world right now, I do wonder how much opinion columns cost an outlet in terms of readership, as well as how much they draw.
I think you need a balance. You can't just have one voice. You need a balance of voices. But I do believe that a balance of voices, analyzing subjects from different points of view, can really help readers think that I would rather read an argument for something and an argument against it rather than a reporter going, he said, she said, he said, she said, all the way down and leaving it up to me to try to figure out who's got the stronger argument based on these little fragments. I would like to see strong voices on either side so that I can get a sense of what the actual debate is. And I'm speaking here as a reader.
So I want to end by asking you both, I'm occasionally asked for, you know, young people ask advice trying to get into journalism. And I got to say, I'm a little conflicted about whether to advise people to get into this line of work. The work is great. It's still a great way to spend your time and make a living if you can. But it seems like it's increasingly harder to make a living, at least, and maybe it's just in, you know, sort of the old ways of thinking at a newspaper, at a radio station or something. And if you can make a go on Substack, great. But what advice do you offer to young people who might be interested in following in your footsteps today?
Well, I'll go first. My daughter was the was an editor at her high school paper and was the editor in chief at her college paper. And I'm glad that she has pursued a career in architecture rather than journalism, because I think that that the future, as you point out, Brian, the opportunities are there, but the salaries are just aren't there anymore. That our colleagues are not making the money that they used to make. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten terrifically difficult to make a living, a lifetime of living doing this work. Nevertheless, there are still people who can do it, but the opportunities that were available when Eric and I got into it, you know, it's just so much slimmer now. But what I tend to tell people is, look, if you feel driven, if you would just wake up tormented day after day because you were not trying to make your way in newspapers, in journalism, then do that. Go and try that. But if you are not totally fixated on it, you know, think of something else.
Yeah, I've got to say, it was a great, great run. It was the most interesting career I could possibly imagine having. Three times a week, I got to write about what I wanted to write about. I got to follow my curiosity. I got to talk to thousands of interesting people and explore hundreds of interesting topics. And it didn't feel like work much of the time. It was just a terrific opportunity. And so in that sense, I would recommend it to anybody as a career. On the other hand, when I was hired, I did the math. When I was hired in 1980, I was paid the equivalent in 2020 dollars of about $68,000 a year as someone fresh out of college.
Oh my God.
And the salaries are just absolutely nowhere near that right now. So I
went into journalism not thinking about salaries, not thinking about a living, not thinking about the future.
We were kids.
I didn't know what else to do. And this looked like fantastic work. And it was. But I happened to get lucky, like Eric, and rode the wave of this particular opportunity moment.
Well, I will say we have been lucky to have had the opportunity to be a part of the community you both built at the Tribune as your readers. So Eric Zorn, Mary Schmeek, thank you so much for being with us and talking about your careers and lives at the Tribune with us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having us.